CataractCoach.com, podcast number 23 with Stephen Dell. Now, you may know Stephen Dell from his work with ACOS, A-E-C-O-S, the American European Congress of Ophthalmic Surgery. He's been former president of this organization, helped to found it many years ago. And it's an organization that's designed to have collaboration among ophthalmologists and as well as with industry people who are helping forge our field, develop the instruments and technology that we use to give patients better eyesight. We had a great discussion about things that are important in your future development as a surgeon, but also as an innovator. What makes a meeting great? And what are the best ways to learn? So there's some amazing advice. I know you'll enjoy it. Check it out. So welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today we're talking with Stephen Dell, who runs a private practice in Austin, Texas, but also is a key opinion leader and has been a leader in our field for a long time. He was president of ACOS, the American European College of Ophthalmic Surgery, and has really done a lot with helping younger physicians get into good practices and also work with industry. In fact, my anecdote is back about 15 years ago, I met him in an airport waiting for a plane, and I asked him some advice about the practice situation I was in. It wasn't ideal, and he gave me some sage advice at the time, which we'll get into later in the conversation, but I think we'll have a great time. Steve, welcome.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me, and I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, one thing I really admired about you is you really are a mentor to the younger generations of ophthalmologists. And how did you kind of get into this role, and why is this something that's so important to you?
You know, it's a good question. I don't really know. I guess that I've always been good at sort of putting myself in the shoes of other people. You know, sure. I kind of feel like that's been helpful in communicating with patients as well. I'm trying to communicate something to a patient, I sort of think, well, if I were sitting there, what would I want to know about this? And so when I approach a young physician who's trying to figure out, you know, how do I navigate this crazy world of ophthalmology, particularly as it relates to getting involved in clinical trials, working with industry, you know, I always think back, well, how confusing was it for me when I first started, and what would I want to know then that I now have the benefit of knowing after all these years of, you know, getting beaten up by the profession.
Yeah, you know, I think I can definitely relate to that. We go through these phases or transitions, 30s, kind of 50s, 70s, kind of early career, mid-career, late career.
Yeah.
And early career, boy, just surprising how naive I was looking back.
You know, it's so funny. You mentioned key opinion leader. So this is maybe like a true confessional. I can remember being at some kind of an ad board or some sort of a meeting, and they were saying, well, you know, what do the KOLs have to think about this? You are, you know, the KOLs. So let's hear from some of the KOLs. And I sort of looked at the person next to me and I said, what is a KOL? Like, I didn't really know. Didn't know what the term, I'd been doing it for a while, but I wasn't familiar with the term KOL. I'm thinking like that O's got to be ophthalmology, you know, so, you know, like, you know, and finally somebody kicked me under the table and said it means key opinion leader. And we didn't really set out to become key opinion leader. No. That wasn't really a thing. I just wanted to be involved in the fun stuff. You know, if you think about when you and I started out, there were so many emerging devices,
right?
So many technologies that were really on the cusp of just exploding.
I'm talking about presbyopic IOLs, the thumper's like lasers.
Well, even the eczemers. I mean, you know, when we first started, all those eczemers, you think about all the eczemers that are out now, they were all investigational devices when we first started. Or they were on the cusp of having various approvals. So the, you know, the cool kids were all kind of doing clinical trials for this laser or that IOL or whatever it was. And I wanted to have access to some of that new technology. So it really started out as a desire to get involved in clinical trials and studies with all these amazing new technologies. You know, and I was fortunate enough to come up through the New Orleans system where, you know, as you know, the first eczema laser treatments were ever done.
Sure.
And just having that experience to the explosion of technology that we sort of assumed would always be the case, but it was really a very special moment in ophthalmology in the, I guess, late 90s and
early
2000s, yeah. Where so much of what we take for granted was being developed.
Yeah, I think we go through constant evolution in our field, but every so often we have a revolution.
That's right.
Like an excimer laser was one. I think we're getting there now with maybe presbyopic lenses, hopefully accommodating lenses in the near future.
Absolutely. I mean, that became pretty quickly, you mentioned accommodating lenses, that became sort of a very early focus of my career, and we did our best with the technology that we had, sure, at the time. But I can remember the moment that somebody first proposed or explained the nature of a potential accommodating IOL to me.
Yeah.
I thought that was just the coolest thing that I'd ever heard. So we were accustomed to dealing with the absolute presbyopia pseudophakia, which is not fun. And the idea that you could actually have an implant lens that would provide accommodation, that was amazing. And
sure.
So I knew that I really wanted to be involved in that. And I was somehow able to get myself involved in the early clinical trials for that. And as I saw the results for accommodative IOLs early on, even though they didn't provide as much accommodation as we would have liked or we really needed, we figured out ways to use that technology because it was the only thing available at the time,
right,
that would allow us to provide any sort of accommodation. And that was sort of one of the big launching points for me to become involved in physician education.
Yeah, I think one thing to really emphasize there, yes, those accommodating lenses, the crystal lens early on, gave a range. It wasn't full accommodation of 3 or 4 diopters, but it certainly was a better range, and it kept incredible image quality. But probably the side note that a lot of ophthalmologists don't know in the modern day is that's also what led to the approval by CMS, Center for Medicare Services, in May of 2005 to allow us to have patients have access to that technology and also pay out of pocket for it.
I mean, I can't overemphasize the importance of the contribution of Andy Corley,
sure,
and the team originally at Ionics, and then later Bausch and Lomb. But I had the opportunity to go to CMS to actually present why we thought there should be the ability for patients to pay on their own for something that was covered on one hand, being cataract surgery, but then a component of it being uncovered.
Sure.
I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that that has saved our profession.
Absolutely.
I mean, if we did not have that shared billing, channel where we could spur new innovative development, we could fund research,
right,
we would not have any of the multifocal IOLs that we have now. We wouldn't have the EDOF lenses. We certainly wouldn't see the early stage companies that are now working on next gen accommodating,
right,
IOLs,
right,
which have the potential to revolutionize what we do in ophthalmology. That whole patient pay category would not exist, and we would be practicing essentially internal medicine. We would,
yeah,
be fighting with the government every year for another 3% reduction in our fees.
Mm.
It would be a disaster.
Yeah, it's a hard to imagine, but yeah, that one thing really revolutionized the way we practice ophthalmology, certainly cataract surgery.
Yeah, and I think that maybe younger surgeons who didn't live through those times as practicing physicians
don't realize.
Yeah, they may take that for granted, but just remember that you stand on the shoulders of giants, right? Was it Newton who said
yeah,
that?
Yeah, sure.
And it's so true.
Yeah, no, for sure. It's also, I always think about the millions and millions of patients who would not have benefited from these technologies had that not happened. Millions. Like you said, there would be no EDOF lenses. You wouldn't have all this development of accommodating lenses. Nothing.
Yeah, when you think about any new technology category, be it, let's take the presbyopia correcting IOL category as a whole. There was criticism early on, well, the accommodating lenses don't provide enough function. Well, yeah, sure. Probably the first generation of anything is going to
yeah,
be just a little bit less terrible than what came before it, but certainly don't judge the entire category on the first generation
of
what comes out for any technology. And by the same token, the first multifocals that we had, not that great.
Yeah, comparison to today, for sure.
But it got us thinking about presbyopia. It got us thinking about the mindset of when we were residents, you take out a cataract, the goal was not the elimination of spectacles. It was just the elimination of the cataract. But now think of how things have evolved, that we take out a cataract, we're automatically thinking, well, what is the best refractive outcome for this patient? Is it, do we leave them myopic? Do we give them monovision? Do we attempt to eliminate their distance correction and give them some component of near vision? These are all things that we take for granted now, but those were not even on the table when we started our careers.
Right, now we have a full spectrum of refractive options for cataract patients.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that it's an entire subspecialty now within ophthalmology, refractive surgery. And there are people who are trying to develop that as a separate category, that maybe we think of ourselves as like oculoplastic surgeons or retinal surgeons, that there's a specific subspecialty certification even for refractive surgery. I don't know if that's the right path or not, but I do know that a refractive mindset is something that you either have or don't have.
I think you're right.
Yeah, because your colleagues, that there's some very excellent cataract surgeons who don't really pay attention to the refractive outcomes of their patients. It's just not their priority, and that's perfectly fine. But for those of us who think in terms of, well, let me see what I can do in terms of achieving spectacle independence for my patients, it's a lot of fun to kind of work through the mental problem of, well, this patient sitting in front of me, what's going to be the best outcome for them? And how do I elicit from them what they want after surgery and then regurgitate back to them a solution that will achieve those results?
Right, take into account their needs and desires, their, let's say, refractive state, their anatomy, their biometry, and then come up with a solution that's kind of tailor-made to them.
Yeah, and even their lifestyle. That kind of gets back to what I started with, where I think of myself in the patient's chair. What would I want coming in here? It's interesting because my own two eyeballs, me as a patient, I have natural monovision. I was just sort of born that way, or I evolved that way. I used to have great distance vision, but as I got into my teens and early 20s, I started to develop myopia in my non-dominant eye. So I'm kind of naturally plano and minus two now.
Wow.
And I wasn't so thrilled with that when I was 30, but now I love it.
Yeah, that's a gift.
It's really a gift. So I very rarely wear any type of correction. Now put in a contact lens to go snow skiing. So in flat light, I want to be able to see the terrain, but that's about it. Maybe it's a really nice way to be. Monovision is a, wouldn't you say that among ophthalmologists and optometrists, if they have a choice, a lot of them choose
it's
monovision?
Very common.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've done surgery about 70 ophthalmologists.
70?
70, yeah, a lot.
Wow.
Maybe because they're all out in LA, but
I don't even know if I know 70 ophthalmologists.
Most I don't know, personally, but I think probably like 50-ish maybe have chosen some degree of monovision.
That's interesting.
Very common.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I bet, do you use the light adjustable lens at all?
I actually was in the original, you talk about trials, I was in the original 2009 trial.
Yeah, wow.
So that's a neat option too, to be able to put that in and then adjust for exactly what the patient wants.
Yeah, I mean, I find that a lot of ophthalmologists and optometrists, they like that idea of the adjustability because, let's face it, we're difficult people, right? We would be difficult patients.
I'd be the worst.
Yeah, I applaud you for operating on 70 of us lunatics.
It's actually easy. You just tell them, what lens do you want? I'll do it for you. And then I do one other thing. I give them a video of their surgery because I said, I know you're going to ask me, so here's a video.
Yeah. I when my time comes for cataract surgery, God, that would be nerve-wracking. You're sitting there, everything that's happening, every single step. He's like, he's doing the capsulotomy now. Or,
too much.
That was a pretty aggressive hydro dissection there. I don't know. I'd need a fair bit of sedation, I think.
Yeah, I think we all would. The magic of the percent.
Exactly.
But where do you think we're going with accommodating lens? So I actually was involved with one company, still involved, the LensGen Juveen Lens. Mm-hmm. I was lucky enough to do the first implantations on humans in 2015. And now, gosh, 8 years later, I suppose we're starting an FDA trial. I want to see more horses in that race even.
Yeah. Accommodation is really hard.
Yeah.
I started working with two companies principally, but mostly Bausch & Lomb, early on in developing a next generation accommodating IOL, and went through many iterations of designs and implantations outside the US, actually getting to the point where we put in, I think, about 55 implant lenses of various iterations.
Sure.
And I can, as you well know, it's really difficult to achieve the two principal goals in an accommodating IOL. Number one, you have to have refractive predictability that's excellent. You know, if you've got great accommodation, but you can't achieve good distance vision, the game's over. Right. Nobody's, that's a dead product. So number one, you've got to achieve very good refractive predictability at the level of our current IOLs, because, you know, with monofocals or with EDOF or multifocals, the new generation IOL formulas, the precision with which we can measure the various biometric parameters of the eye, the recognition of the importance of ocular surface disease treatment before we measure these patients,
sure,
those have really allowed us to home in very closely on our refractive goals. And so that's become the standard, and the bar there has been raised significantly. So if you can't achieve really good distance acuity, it doesn't matter how much accommodation you really have. So then the second goal is that you need a degree of sustained accommodation that's much, much higher than we had with the original accommodation.
What do you got magic numbers? 3-4 diopters?
I think it's about four. I think you need to have about 4 diopters of peak accommodation, because that probably means you've got 2 diopters of sustained accommodation.
Yeah.
And I think that that's an important distinction, because if you, in a clinical trial, ask somebody to eke out these 5 letters on the J1 line and they can just do it, that's very, very different than having...
Read a whole book.
Yeah, reading fluency, where somebody sits on an airplane with a little light up there and holds a book and can read it. You know, that's a different animal. So you need about double the accommodative amplitude at a peak that... to have a good, sustained, comfortable accommodation.
I'm convinced, though, it's going to happen. I'm hopeful, and hopefully in the next 5-ish, 10 years, we'll have a truly accommodating lens. But I think it's a great time to be an ophthalmologist.
Yeah, there are a few really good, promising technologies, and some of them we'll discuss at this ACOS meeting here in Deer Valley. We'll have those presented. But it really is gratifying to see money being invested, time, effort, energy being invested in that space, which, as we mentioned a few minutes ago, would not exist without that shared pay category in ophthalmology. I mean, can you imagine trying to develop these technologies where there was no, there's no economic model that would allow these companies to be successful? That's just never going to happen.
Yeah, it's just so crazy how just that one little effect. Thank you, Andy Corley and team.
Absolutely.
That's such an amazing
impact. They deserve all the credit.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Speaking of ACOS, tell me more about this. So you're one of the founding members here for ACOS, and now it's evolved. It's become one of my absolute favorite meetings. I really love this meeting. And it's like, I already got next year's dates and put them on my calendar.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. You know, ACOS is, I guess I was the second president. So I was the founding president-elect of ACOS. Steve Slade was the first president of ACOS. And that sort of the idea behind this, a lot of the credit goes to David Cox. You know, the idea that we have this siloed, you know, we've got the physicians over here in a silo, and we've got industry over here in a silo. And David kind of thought, well, there are no products that we use that are not the result of a collaboration between industry and physicians. There's never been anything done in ophthalmology that wasn't a collaboration between those two groups. So what if we had a society that actually had members who were leaders in industry, and coupled that with members who were leaders in ophthalmology on the physician side and non-physician scientists?
Right.
And so that's a very unusual combination. And And that's, and the society is in fact unique in that regard, that we have full-fledged members. For example, at this meeting, we have a program committee member, Aaron Powers, who is actively employed in industry. And to have that equal footing so that everybody is on the same basis, everybody has the same status within the organization, the leadership consists of industry members and physician members. It's really allowed us to advocate for our specialty with sure. regulatory agencies. It's allowed us to get, in fact, we did the first, we got the first approval for corneal cross-linking as an ACOS-sponsored study, where we were able to go to FDA and say, listen, we as a society represent industry and physicians. This is a true clinical unmet need. We have patients who are needlessly to corneal transplantation. And in Europe, those patients are being cross-linked.
Right.
And that's not happening. So what can we do collectively to help our patients? And so when we have those triple wins, where industry wins, where our patients win, and physicians win, that's a really gratifying thing to see. And we don't have any designs for ACOS to be a giant organization, but I'd rather it to have the right small number of individuals.
Sure.
And I kind of feel, and I think you probably feel the same way, I learn more at these ACOS meetings than I do at 10 of the larger meetings.
Well, one of the reasons I think I love this meeting is there are no lectures.
That's right.
Every presentation is purely a case presentation,
video.
It's all about the, and a basic level of understanding is assumed.
Yeah, you can blame that on me because I have such a short attention span. I just hate sitting through lectures.
Yeah.
I really do. And you know, if you think about the typical lecture you see at one of the larger meetings, the first 3, 4, 5, 6 slides have to explain that, well, the implant is made out of this material and it's got this diameter and here is the A constant for it. Or, you know, they have to explain the basics. It is assumed that that's all known.
Yeah.
Or if you don't know it, then you go Google it.
You
can go look it up somewhere. It's not. So we use cases as a means of illustrating the true crux of the issue. So for example, if you have a new technology like the ICA, like the Apthera, the ICA, we know what it is. We know what it looks like. We know what the pinhole is supposed to be doing. Where does that lens really work? So I'll present a case later today. Here's a patient where we had a very difficult clinical problem. Someone with an extreme degree of irregular astigmatism after RK with a bizarre refraction. How can you use that lens to fix this guy's right eye?
Right.
So we're talking about his right. We're not talking about the Apthera as a product in general, but we're talking about Mr. Blank's right eye. How did we fix him?
Yeah, for sure. The case studies are the best, especially because we do here at this meeting a few minutes of the case study and then a bunch of minutes about the discussion and the debate.
Yeah, like 10 minutes of just discussion. That's, I think, super helpful.
Yeah, even for my cataract coach session here at the meeting, just a few minutes of video, but the videos are no right answer. Like one of them, I'll give you previews. Well, what IOL do you put in this 16-year-old with bilateral 20/1 cataracts? There's not a great answer.
Yeah.
And so I'm sure the panelists are all going to have differing opinions.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole basis of the case presentation model, which is, if I'm sitting in the audience, I want to think, well, what would I do here? You know, again, putting yourself in the other person's chair. What would I do in this situation? I always loved case presentations as an audience member because I could see myself in that surgeon's role. Oh, well, what would I do here? I wouldn't do that. That seems kind of crazy. Or maybe I agree with that particular solution. You know. So,
but sometimes I get convinced of alternate opinions. Like I used to think, for RK patients, no, I just stick with a monofocal lens.
Right.
And then I saw a case presentation where someone said, no, here's where I put an EDOF in.
Mm, yeah.
And it actually turned out better. And I was like, you know, I'm going to take that advice.
Yeah, I think you do see conventional wisdom get challenged at this meeting. And I think that's very helpful because you go up on the podium and you're going to hear, well, this lens is approved to do A, B, and C at a major meeting. And you can't even really discuss using it outside the lines.
These off-label things that we're doing.
Absolutely. But you know, what I used to learn in the hallways, that's where you really learn. If you go to the large meetings, what you learn in the hallways after you've heard the lecture in the big room, and then you see your buddy out in the hallway and say, well, what do you really do? You know, what do you, well, you know, how do you really use this? And that's what a meeting like ACOS is designed to be. We take that hallway experience and make that the whole meeting.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. It's done very, very well. I got to commend you guys. The whole committee who puts the meeting on it has become one of my absolute, and I do probably 20 meetings a year.
20 meetings a year?
Oh, I've already done like 4 countries this year. I got 10 international trips this year. So I'm all over the place, but it's absolutely one of my most favorite meetings. You guys done a great job. Now, talking about putting yourself in other people's positions, I'll go back to what I said at the very beginning of the intro. So one of the best bits of advice you gave me was back in maybe 2009-ish, and I was in a practice situation that wasn't ideal for me.
Yeah.
And I kind of picked your brains and asked your advice, and you just said, hey, it's okay to put yourself first. It's okay to just put you and your family first and do what's best for you, and it's okay to change gears.
Wow, I mean, that's such a daunting task to do something like that. I don't remember where I was in my career at that time, but, you know, I started out, I joined a couple of doctors out of training, and we were literally the three clowns next to Toys R Us. We were in a strip, like not a strip mall, but like a, you know, a retail center that had a professional building in it. And there was a Toys R Us. I don't know if people, they don't have Toys R Us anymore.
No, they went bankrupt.
Yeah. So there's a Toys R Us next to us. And, you know, we grew that practice to about 20 physicians and optometrists over the years through acquisitions and hiring. And that's a very steep growth trajectory. And that became the dominant practice in Austin, Texas. And, you know, it was sort of impossible to fail when the city around you is growing
that rapidly.
As long as you just do reasonably good work, you're probably going to be pretty successful. And that practice got very large. At some point, I found that what I was gravitating toward were these premium lenses, were these technologies like LASIK. And I found that I was eventually unable to deliver the type of patient experience that I wanted to, a gigantic practice that was a soup to nuts, multi-location practice with, you know, lots and lots of employees, like a couple hundred employees. And so at some point I actually split off and had a purely, I guess you might even refer to it as a boutique practice.
Sure.
Where really all we do are premium technologies. And the patient experience is like staying at this, you know, St. Regis or a Ritz-Carlton or a Four Seasons or something like that. And so I want, when the patient comes in to the office, I want them to feel like, okay, these people seem like they know what they're doing. Again, putting yourself in the position of the patient.
Yes.
And when they walk into the reception area and they see curated art or they see curated books, something as simple as, you know what, I bet in my patient base there's a group of people who are really into motorcycles, dogs, cats, World War II memorabilia, you know, contemporary art. I need something for everybody to feel at home, because if you think about it, because I treat patients for LASIK and I do refractive lens exchange and cataract surgery, those are different patient
populations. Sure.
Yeah, I need people who are interested in graphic novels, but also, you know, Battle of the Bulge, right? It's a very different, but you need to make it cool and, you know, professional looking in a way that makes people feel at home, at ease. And then you can have these important conversations with them about how we're going to fix their vision in a way that makes them have confidence in the technology, but also in the practice.
Sure. I do the same thing. I have a boutique practice, and I have only one rule. I give the same level of care that I want to receive. Like you said, put yourself in the patient's position. Yeah. That's exactly what I do.
I mean, it's like the simplest rule, right? Just, you know.
I think we learned it in kindergarten, right?
Right.
The golden rule.
Right. It's probably the basis for most of the world's religions. Just treat everybody else like you want to be treated, and that's fine. If you just did that, you probably need like one commandment. You know, like just that's it.
Just be a good person.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the other thing too is patients sometimes don't realize that this surgery is going to change the way you see the world every waking moment for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
If you're going to spend money on anything, spend it on this.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, there's a bunch of ways to frame that in a discussion. But you could say, yes, you could say, well, what else do you own that you're going to use every waking moment of your life forever? That's a powerful statement. Or, you know, sometimes you have tech-oriented people who come in and say, listen, if you're going to have to watch a TV for the rest of your life, you probably buy the 8K version, right? Or, you know, by the time maybe it's 16K or whatever. But you want to buy the very, very best television you can possibly get. Because you're stuck with it. Because sometimes patients, and I know you've had the same experience, the patients will say, well, could you upgrade this in a few years if something better comes out? And the answer, as you know, is kind of like, well, probably not. You know, it's tough to do that.
I said, if you want a lens exchange, I could probably do it. But think of last resort, and just you have to know as the patient, it's going to take a week off of my life.
Yeah. You know, it can be done, but it's not like changing your shirt. You know, it's one of those things that we don't do lightly, and it would not be done as a matter of course. Yeah.
So going back to like the young physicians, if you are a young physician, one of the sayings I always learned was that your first practice, your first job is like your first girlfriend or boyfriend. They're great and all, and I know you love them, but may not be the one you're with forever, and that's okay.
It is okay. And in fact, I think the statistics probably bear that out. I think that most people eventually end up in a practice. Well, I don't know if that's right. I honestly don't know what the numbers are, but a good chunk of people that we know are in practice situations that are different than when they first started.
For sure.
But there are also people who are still with the same practice that they first joined, and they spend their careers there. And, I think it's important, as you know, it's important to get along with the people that you work with.
For sure.
You know, it's just not worth it. Let's say you're in a situation where you're making a ton of money and, you know, things are just great financially, but you just hate the people you work with.
Oh, it's not worth it. You know,
it just can't stand coming in. It's just not worth it. Yeah. You know, you may take a hit for a year or two or three, making a change, but in the long run, you know, you need to be happy.
Well, that's great advice. Yeah, don't exchange your happiness, your peace of mind, your time for money. If you're going to be miserable, please, okay, let me give you permission, shift gears.
You know, and another corollary to that, and some younger physicians have asked me this in the past. They've said, well, I've got this incredible opportunity, and I like the practice, I like the people, but it is in a location that I really don't want to live in. But I think I got it figured out. I'm going to take Fridays off, and I'm going to buy an airplane, and I'm going to fly away every weekend, and I'm going to leave the place that I hate, and then I'm going to go to the place that I love. And I think, well, that sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah.
You know, like, why don't you just go and live where you want to live, and it'll work itself out. So you can go to, you know, the most competitive, you're in an incredibly competitive market. If you want to live in Los Angeles, you'll figure out a way to thrive in Los Angeles. If somebody wants to live in Austin, Texas, where we've got a ton of ophthalmologists who've moved in, it's a very competitive market, someone will figure out a way to make it work if they really want to live there. And that's true for wherever your particular desired place to live is. So I my advice always is pick the place you want to live first and foremost.
I totally agree with you. And another thing that young ophthalmologists may not realize is the volume of cataract surgery is increasing rapidly in the country.
Yeah.
While LASIK may be relatively flat, 20 years ago we were doing less than 2 million cataracts a year. Now we're doing 4 million a year in the U.S., so double number. But we're dwindling number of surgeons.
True.
More surgeons are returning than we're producing. There are only 460 new ophthalmologists created in America per year. And a lot of them don't want to go back to the days of working 80 hours a week, A lot of them want to actually have a work-life balance.
Yeah, that's true. You know, we're starting to see, I think, the first cracks in the system in terms of physician shortages.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is the experience that you've had in LA, but if one of your friends calls you and says, hey, could you recommend a pediatric cardiologist for my friend's son who needs to get in to see somebody, it's very difficult to get into almost any surgical subspecialist right now.
Mm-hmm.
And while there are still ophthalmologists out there who would love to have a little bit more cataract surgery, I think most of the people that I know are busier than they've ever been,
right,
and are about as busy as they want to be.
Right.
And they're now thinking in terms of, well, how can I sculpt these, let's say I do 15 cases a week, how do I sculpt these 15 so that they're the 15 cases I want to do?
Right.
You know, that the mix of those cases really becomes the ones that I want to operate on. And I think that you're absolutely correct that we're unprepared for the coming tsunami of cataract patients.
Like, yes.
If you think about it, in 10 or 15 years, we're going to have to be doing 30, 40% more surgery than we are right now.
Easily.
We're not ready for that.
And you'll have, hopefully, an accommodating lens, so you'll have these 50-something-year-olds who are coming in for refractive lens exchange.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I don't have the capacity to do 30% more surgery. I'm not going to do it. So somebody's got to. And if we're net losing ophthalmologists every year, because I know that more retire than are coming on board, we're going to have to get more creative in how we spend our time. And it's going to be surgical, not,
not blepharitis and red eye?
Surgeons will not be doing that, or at least a lot of surgeons will not be doing that. I started to see, maybe you've had this experience in Los Angeles, but for the first time ever, we've had problems getting anesthesiologists to cover our cases.
It is tough.
It's just been really fascinating. We have a very busy ASC that's, you know, would be a, I guess 10 years ago would have been considered a crown jewel, you know, for an anesthesia group to come in and have that many cases. The group that we've worked with for decades just recently told us, hey, listen, we really like you guys. You're super efficient. We don't have the manpower to service you anymore.
Wow.
And we'll be gone in 60 days or whatever it was. Some shockingly short period of time. And we had to scramble to find new coverage. And in fact, it was quite difficult. And I've heard from others that they're having the same problems. And I know that there is a looming shortage of anesthesiologists. And that's got to be true in all specialties.
Yeah, I mentioned my whole family's doctors. Yeah. And so, yeah, and on almost every subspecialty, there are absolute shortages. Like you said earlier, pediatric cardiologist, good luck finding one. If you find one, good luck getting an appointment.
Yeah. How about a rheumatologist? Because we overlap with them a little bit on some of our dry eye patients. If I tried to get a patient in to see a rheumatologist, you know, that's very difficult.
How about even a neuro-ophthalmologist? A fellow ophthalmologist, a neuro-ophthalmologist, impossible to get an appointment the next month.
What's that?
Your patients with optic neuritis, those guys.
Oh, yeah. That's that rope in the back of the eye.
It's something like that. Okay. You got to focus the light real perfectly, and then they take it.
I always wondered what happened after the lens.
No, but in all seriousness, I think you made another important point, which is okay to evolve your practice over time. You may start off doing everything. When I first went into practice right out of residency,
right,
I did everything. Everything was. I had a great residency experience where I did a ton of cases. So I did everything from, like, in a day, I could do a ptosis surgery, I could do a strabismus surgery, I do a bunch of cataracts,
PKs,
I do
glaucoma traps, all that stuff,
And then end the day with some diabetic PRP.
Yeah. It's way easier to limit than to expand later. You know, you should probably start broad, and then you can, you know, sort of focus in. It's very difficult in let's say you're 5 or 10 years into practice to try to adopt in a completely new component of your practice, where you say, okay, I'm going to start doing retina injections. You know, it's not that hard to do, you know, technically. But the clinical decisions, you just haven't been in that mindset for a while. So it's a lot easier to you know, focus down and edit than to expand later.
No, that's absolute. Yeah. And I think especially when you're first out of training, gosh, your knowledge base is amazing.
Yeah.
Like, I know if you're in your first year or two of practice, you still know what A pattern and B pattern for business is. Don't ask someone who's been in cataracts only for about 50 years.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so, we're diagnosing a fourth nerve palsy. You're kind of showing off to...
The three-step test.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you still remember that, you know. You remember studying for the OCAP
quiz? Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, the OCAP quiz we take every year. You know, somewhere it's back there. The knowledge is still there. And if you can figure out how to access it.
Yeah.
Hopefully that hard drive is not frozen up.
But also important that even as we narrow our focus, we have to still keep learning. So just, I mean, think, the way you do surgery today is not the way you did it 10 years ago, certainly not the way you did it 20 years ago. And even when we did our training, there was no femtocytic laser. There were no eczema. Well, eczema lasers barely come in on the market.
Yep.
There was no lamellar corneal transplantation. There was no OCT machine. There was no anti-VEGF treatment.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, we have lived through, you know, and I kind of feel like we're in the golden age of ophthalmology right now, if you think about it. You know, everybody, you know, I will never forget this, because when I first went to one of the major national meetings, I was sitting having a cup of coffee, and I'd just come out of the lecture, like the main lecture hall, where they were talking about fee cuts and, you know, we're going to be, and cataract surgery's gone from this much to this much, and it's going to go down to this much. And I came out of that auditorium thinking, like, gosh, I feel like I've signed on to be a, you know, like a farmer, like the American, you know, or something like the, some, at the time, you know, like the American farm seemed like it was dying. And I felt like I had, this is a terrible, what's going on here? And next to me happened to be sitting, I don't even know who he was, but some older ophthalmologist. And he said, you have no idea how great things are right now. It used to, yes, we used to get $3,000 an eye for cataract surgery, but it used to take 30 minutes to do, or 40 minutes to do cataract surgery. Now you can do it in 10 minutes or 15 minutes, and one day you'll be able to do it in 5 minutes. And things are going to be fantastic. And I have no idea who that doctor was, but that little brief interaction over a cup of coffee outside of a conference, you know, a big meeting room, was very impactful. And it's turned out to be very, very true. And right now, if you think about it, the golden age of ophthalmology, we have the ability to have presbyopia correcting IOLs. Our laser vision correction options are phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know, you wonder why LVC volumes are kind of flat when we can very reliably produce better than 20/20 vision
in
so many of our patients. We have the ability to treat glaucoma in a way that we certainly didn't.
The whole mid spectrum, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, when I was a baby ophthalmologist, you know, pilocarpine QID was kind of normal, or beta blocker. And those didn't really do all that great of a job and made patients feel kind of lousy. And
for sure.
And think about the MIGS options that we have now that didn't exist. In almost every component of our specialty, things are way better. ARMD, think about the, you know, what do you do for ARMD back in the, when we first started?
Macular translocation surgery.
Photodynamic therapy, or, you know, they just laser the macula and hope that it's somewhat less horrible than it was before. Yeah, I mean, we have a whole slew of technological innovations that have allowed us to practice in a way that is so different than 20, 25 years ago.
Yeah, and then the corollary is going to keep progressing. So for the young ophthalmologists, do not worry. I encourage my own kids. This ophthalmology is an amazing thing. I am thankful every day to be an ophthalmologist. It's a blessing. Absolute blessing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you've been so involved in physician education over the years, and sometimes you hear griping from a resident or a fellow, and, you know, you have to pull them aside and say, listen, you know, no offense to any internists, but you know, the worst day in ophthalmology is better than the best day in internal medicine. And that's, I really believe that. And I always, every day I go to work and I kind of feel like this is just so incredible. We're using these amazing lasers and this incredible technology, and our surgeries are quick and the recovery is so fast and the outcomes are great and patients come up to you in restaurants and say, Dr. Devgan, you changed my life. And, you know, I don't think people, you know, the oncologists don't get that. You know, it's just a very different type of, kind of specialty, and we're privileged to be in it.
Got a funny story for you. Once when my kids were in their mid-teenage years, you know, where they're embarrassed of their own dad.
Yeah.
And we're at Costco together.
Right.
And this woman runs up to me and says, Dr. Devgan, thank you. You're the best. And she tells my kids, do you know how great your dad is? Your dad, I was almost blind. Now I have perfect vision. All thanks to your dad. Your dad's the best. And my kids are like, him?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that woman would like, but yeah, you're right. I can go to places like Costco. Yeah. And patients will recognize me and come up to me and say thank you.
Yeah, and your kids are like awkward. Yeah.
But I think it really, yeah, no, we're so fortunate. It's an amazing field here.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's taxing. You know, it's hard work.
Yeah.
It requires, you know, a lot of, you have to do a lot of things right. You know, you think about it, to be a successful ophthalmologist, how many different categories of tasks do you need to be good at? You need to understand optical physics.
Yeah.
Got to be good with your hands.
Really good. With micro hands. Yeah. Micro procedures.
Yeah, you got to be really good with your hands. You've got to have, probably the most important thing is know when not to operate.
Surgical judgment.
Yeah. Know when to stop.
Yeah.
You know, as you train doctors, and you know what's the most important word in surgery when you're coaching another surgeon? Stop.
Yeah.
Stop.
Right.
Don't do that anymore.
Right.
Stop.
Yeah.
Let's stop. Let's take a breath and let's see where we are, and then let's make a plan. Because you know your surgeon, the tendency is to, oh, I can fix this. Let me go deeper. No, that's deep enough.
Stop digging.
Yeah.
Once you get a certain depth, stop digging.
Yeah, you've struck oil.
Yeah, no, there's actually a ton of important lessons teaching residents. That's certainly one of them. But yeah, you said earlier, surgical judgment, that's a tough one too.
Yeah.
Knowing when not to, because you come in the residency, you're just about operating. Anyone needs surgery? I'll do the surgery. Let's do it.
That's right. When not to. That's really important. And, you know, that 10,000 hours Malcolm Gladwell thing, I think that's real. You know, I used to, when you came out, you were an excellent surgeon. I thought I was a good surgeon in the first 5 years. Thought I was pretty good. And then you realize, oh, there's a whole other level here. And then you realize, oh, wow, there's a whole other room of levels here that you didn't even really know about. And
right.
And that's what's rewarding about our career is that you just keep getting better and better and better. I guess maybe it's like golf. You know, golf is the simplest sport in the world.
Yeah.
Put this ball in that hole using that stick. It's a one sentence instruction.
Right.
But there are probably people who spend their lives perfecting that, and they get better and better and better in ways that don't appear immediately obvious.
Yeah, like on cataract coach, I say cataract surgery takes years to learn, but a lifetime to master.
Well, that's a great quote, honestly, because I think that kind of sums it up very nicely. That it is relatively easy to be a journeyman cataract surgeon.
Sure.
Relatively easy. Still pretty hard. But to get to your level, I mean, that's something else. And you really have to refine your craft and think of yourself as an artist, not as a journeyman.
Not as a technician.
Yeah, this is not an assembly line. I'm not just cranking these out. I want each one of these to be as good as I can possibly make it.
Yeah, and keep learning. That's the best part, too. I was in the Brazilian cataract refractive meeting about 6-8 weeks ago, and was had their live surgery event. Wow, such incredible surgeons. And I even met a surgeon. I thought high volume was, okay, let's do a few thousand a year. I met a surgeon who does more than 10,000 cataracts a year. Like he's done 280,000 cataracts.
Wow.
And his skill is just unbelievable.
It's a good sized city.
It's an amazing setup. But yeah, we got to keep learning and keep evolving it over time. And that's the beauty why I had a cataract coach. Just 5 minutes a day, I'll show you something very interesting, very new every day. And you'll pick something up. Because like you, I've got a short attention span.
Well, you know, I congratulate you because I don't know, you must receive feedback on how broadly that has impacted our specialty, right. But there are so many surgeons who use that resource as a way of, I've got a case, I haven't done one of these in a year. Let me see what's on Cataract Coach, and I can just refresh a couple of things in my mind about pointers that I want to keep, in the forefront of my thinking when I do this case. And it's been a really wonderful resource, and I congratulate you. I mean, it's got to be a labor of love. You must love it because it's got to take so much time.
It takes a ton of time, but I absolutely love it, and it's something that I actually learn more than I contribute. I get sent 5 to 10 videos a day. I watch them all.
Wow.
So even that takes time.
Yeah.
But it's helpful now that I'm an empty nester. My kids are grown up out of the house, and so I've got more time.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier about doing research and being involved in new technologies.
Sure.
That forces you to stay at the forefront.
Yeah.
It forces you to up your game. Because people call you up and they say, hey, I have a question about this technology. You better be prepared for those questions. Or if
right.
you're training other surgeons, you'd think, well, that's a good question. I better know the answer to that. And I think that keeps it interesting, but it also keeps us current.
For sure. And I think I encourage all the young doctors. I really enjoy the many, many years I've worked with industry because you really get to dictate the future of our specialty. And you have some very important pearls if you are going to work with industry, which I love what you said. Industry has their goals, and your goals, though, are different.
Yeah, that's right.
Can you elaborate on that?
That's right. So, I mean, you think about the our colleagues who work in industry, they've got their products. These products are like their children.
Yeah.
Literally, their job is to grow these products. That is what their purpose in this industry is. We have a slightly different role. We don't work for industry. We work with industry. We work for our patients.
Correct.
And so if there are aspects of a particular technology that you're being asked to speak about that you think are not quite what they should be, I would encourage emerging leaders in ophthalmology, go ahead and speak out. Say, hey, listen, I use this particular technology in situations A, B, and C, but in D, E, and F, it's actually not the right choice. I don't like the way it performs in that situation. And sometimes I find surgeons are reluctant to say things like that from the podium because they think, oh, well, the company doesn't want me to speak on their behalf in the future, or I won't get the next clinical trial. That's nonsense. The companies want to know that you are an honest dealer, that you're a broker of I guess the best way to put it would be reliable information.
Sure. A broker of truth.
Yeah, and that you're credible, you're a credible speaker, and that you're going to tell your audience the way things really are. I always loved, you knew Lee Nordan.
Oh, for sure. Fantastic guy.
And what an incredible role model he was, because he would always tell you the truth about a product, even if he was the mouthpiece of that. He was the product champion of that particular device or whatever it was. He would say, listen, this is really nice to have, but you don't need it. That was Lee for you, that he would say, it's great, but there are workarounds. Or, you know what, it's phenomenal, but I would wait for the next generation. So I always admired that independent thought and that truthful, honest broker, way that he conducted himself.
Absolutely. He was an absolute straight shooter. He gave me some valuable advice. He says, it'll take you 5 years to build credibility.
Mm-hmm.
It'll take you 5 minutes to lose it.
That's very true.
That's brilliant advice.
Yeah.
So be true to yourself, be true to your patients. I think you can't go wrong. And take on projects in industry that you actually enjoy, that you actually have an interest in.
Yeah.
I don't want to be involved in the FDA trials of dry eye stuff. I just don't. It's just not me.
Yeah. Yeah, and you shouldn't be doing it then.
Right.
And by the same token, I think it's useful to work with more than one company.
Yo, that's great advice. Absolutely.
Yeah, because if you get sort of perceived as, oh, big surprise, Dr. Such and Such likes the product from this company. Mm-hmm. I've noticed that she always works with that company, exclusively works with that company. I think maybe she works for that company. You know, like that can be, that's a problem. You really do lose credibility. You need to, you need to work with the best products in every category of what you practice.
Right, if you work for just one company exclusively across the board, you may have a conflict of interest.
Yeah.
If you work for many companies, it's hard to have a conflict of interest.
Yeah, and it's highly unlikely that any given company has the very best product in every single category.
Oh, for sure.
Right? I mean, that would be a, you're into riding bicycles, right?
Sure. Okay. Mountain bikes.
Right.
I'm not very good.
You're not, okay. Well,
but I enjoy it.
Yeah, but it's probably the case that, the very best manufacturer of brakes doesn't also make the very best tires.
Right.
Something like that. There's probably some amalgamation of the very best components that you can put together for biking, which I don't know much about. But the same thing is true in ophthalmology. And at a very high level, it's probably a little bit from this company, a little bit from that company. And that allows us to work for our patients.
So you're a young doc starting in practice. You got a job. You think for right now it's pretty good for you. You're happy in the location you want. You want to be more involved with working with one of these companies or participating at, on the podium or on a panel. What's your first step? How do you get involved?
It's surprisingly easy. It really is. And here's what you do. Let's say you have a product that you really like and you think, wow, I would really like to get involved in the next generation of this product, or I want to expand the use of this product. Tell your local rep, hey, I really like this product. Mm-hmm. I want to get more involved. Because those reps are the first point of contact for all of these companies. And that rep will then say, they will send an email that day to their supervisor saying, hey, I met this young surgeon, very promising surgeon. They really like our technology. I think we need to get them involved in a regional, speaker program for our technology. And then that will get kicked up the chain to the next person above that. Mm-hmm. And before you know it, you'll be on an advisory board, or you will be asked to provide your input on a particular product. And you'll be meeting with higher and higher level people at that company, because those companies are actively seeking out who are the next generation of surgeons, who are the surgeons who like our products, who are interested in this space. And you can very, very quickly, I've seen this so many times, very, very quickly get involved at a high level with these companies. So that's what I would recommend. The very first step is to find a technology that you like, tell your local rep that you do like it and what you like about it, and that you want to get involved.
Yeah, I did the same thing many, 20 years ago. It's kind of how I got my foot in the door there. And they brought me on and said, okay, well, we're actually developing the next iteration of this. Advise us.
Yeah.
It blew my mind.
Yeah, I mean, because think of the market research for them. This is their actual customer.
Right.
Telling them, hey, could you please next year make the tires a little wider or a little narrower or whatever it is. And this is what they want to hear. You are the person they want to hear from. And you'd be surprised. You think, I'm just a young doctor. I'm only in practice for a year. They don't know who I am. They want to hear from you. They really do.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, I'm gonna wrap this up and end with one important thing, which is how do you see your practice transitioning as you get older? And then what are the differences between, let's say, being an ophthalmologist in your 30s, kind of early career, 50s, mid-career, where we are now, and then what do you think is going to be, let's say, 70s, late career?
Well, yeah. I mean, you kind of touched on some of this earlier, but when you're in your 30s, it's just like all comers. I want everything. And then you start sculpting. You start saying, okay, I really just want to see this type of surgical problem. And I'm really not going to I'm certainly not going to practice medical ophthalmology, because they just don't have the bandwidth to do that.
Sure.
And so you first get yourself full surgically, And then you start sculpting the nature of that surgery so that it is the type of surgery that you really want to do. And then I guess maybe if you sort of look way into the future, ophthalmology is one of those specialties that you can kind of practice half-time, I think.
Right.
You know, there you can't be a half-time neurosurgeon, I don't think.
No, because you have to be married to the hospital, remember?
Yeah, you have to be, yeah, they're going to want you there. And
at least 80 hours a week.
Yeah, something like that. So, but, you know, you could, and we certainly know people who do this, you could practice like a couple days a week or maybe less, where you operate a day and maybe you have a 2 half-days of clinic. Mm-hmm. And you could just sort of loaf along doing that for a really long time. I do think, and I know that you've been an advocate for this, you got to keep yourself physically active.
Sure.
You know, I don't think you can be a surgical athlete unless you're doing something else athletically in your life. And, it, you know, whether that's walking or triathlons or whatever it is, you got to keep yourself physically active. Sure. Because, you know, we are essentially very skilled laborers.
Yeah.
You know,
for sure.
Chop off our hands and our surgical volume is going to go way down. So, I mean, you know, you got to, we're essentially piecemeal workers.
Right.
And it may be that, you know, one time somebody said, well, what do you do? I said, like, well, I'm really like a microscopic underwater demolition expert, you know, because I'm
just, you think about it.
You know, I'm destroying these cataracts, demolishing them, removing them, and then I'm replacing them.
Within the space of a fraction of a season.
Yeah. You know, if I go up a millimeter too high, total disaster. If I go down a millimeter too low, total disaster. You know, and so it's, so, but you can sort of, if you keep yourself physically active, you can practice. Gosh, I think Kobe Kraft's father, when he retired from surgery, he was like the oldest surgeon on the planet, period.
Oh, man, special?
In any specialty.
Yeah.
You know, no one could find an older surgeon.
Wow.
You know, I'm not sure that's the distinction that I want to go for, but I think you could easily continue practicing very high-level ophthalmology if you keep yourself mentally and physically fit into your 70s, into your 70s. I mean, you know, I've seen it done, and, you know, there's probably a few in their early 80s who can do this. So I think that we're very fortunate that our specialty allows that.
Yeah, and I think especially if you said, if you find you've sculpted your practice down to things you just really love.
Yeah.
Like I could see myself maybe in the future whittling it down to just like, all right, I want to do just these IOL surgeries, maybe even stop doing LASIK or other chiropractic and just find my real true passion.
Yeah, you have that luxury when you get to the stage of your career when you can actually do that. But you know, I think that's in the future.
I think we're all lucky to be ophthalmologists. I want to thank you for participating in this podcast. I had a fantastic discussion. And as for my audience, remember, we have a new podcast every single week and more great learning coming up. Thanks again, Steve.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for watching that podcast with Stephen Dell. I'm sure you learned as much as I did and really enjoyed that in-depth conversation. Remember, we've got a new podcast every single week. And you can get these podcasts on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere you find your podcasts. Plus, it's on cataractcoach.com. And you can watch the video of it on YouTube. We'll see you next week.